WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
I'm going to do the interview when we actually play back the tape. I mean, I'm going to do the first... Let me start again. I'm going to introduce you live when we actually play back the tape. So I'm going to start with the first question, but you can assume that I've introduced you and, you know, mentioned your book and so on. So, but we'll just start with the first question now. Are we ready? We rolling? Oh, okay. Can you remember what your first really memorable religious experience was as a child?
Well, I think it was somewhere before five, being taken over to the parish church by my mother. It would have been St. Lucy's Church, which is closed now, on Austin Boulevard in Chicago, just north of the L-tracks. And going in the church and being awed by the darkness and the silence and the red lights glittering up in front, and especially the statues on either side of the aisle. And I'd ask my mother who the saints were and why they were saints and what a saint was. I think that's the first experience I can remember. And it's interesting, of course, because now I argue that we shouldn't let go of saints in Catholicism, that they're important because each saint represents a story. A story that will attract young people. And I'd never even thought of that question until you asked it. I'd forgotten about that visit to St. Lucy's Church. Maybe I'll put that in the revision of Confessions of a Parish Priest.
Were you ever dragged to church or did you
want
to go? Oh,
no. Church was always a fascinating place for me. It still is. I like to drop into churches and sit there in silence and pray.
When did you feel that you were called?
Well, it was in second grade, Derry. Sister Alma Francis asked one day in class, how many boys here want to be priests? Suppose it shows the time, 1937, that she just said boys. Today, of course, how many? So I think half of us put up our hands, and she smiled, and she said, well, maybe one of you will make it. And I looked around, and I figured even then, well, it's going to be tough without the guys. Actually, she was wrong. There's another one. Bishop Lawrence McNamara out somewhere in the plains was a classmate of mine. So she was wrong. There was two of us.
Did you think that you wanted to be a priest because of really serious religious stirrings, or do you think you just wanted to emulate priests who you knew? Like,
well,
people want to become teachers because they know teachers.
Yeah, I think the two of them probably fit together. It was certainly at that stage in life, it was the influence of the priests in the parish for whom I had a great admiration. I liked the things that they did. And I still like the things that priests do. So there was never any profound mystical sense about it. I didn't hear voices from on high. I liked priests and I liked what they did, and that's why I wanted to be a priest, and that's why I still am a priest.
A lot of boys and girls who want to become priests or nuns, once they become teenagers and the hormones start stirring, they give up on that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Did that ever happen to you? Did you ever think, well, maybe I'll just be a teenager and then get married and give up on this?
We didn't have teenagers in those days. Actually, the term teenager only originated in the early 50s. And so what we're talking about, my case, is the late 30s and early 40s. Well, I certainly had at least the requisite number of hormones and was routinely in love with all kinds of young women when I was in light years of grammar school. But that didn't interfere. I had made up my mind that I was going to be a priest, and I was going to be a priest.
When you entered the seminary, did you have very romantic ideas about what life in the seminary was going to be like?
Well, certainly not when I went to Quigley, the high school seminary, which was a day school, because I had older friends that were there. And I knew it was pretty much a high school where you had to work a little harder. And you had school on Saturdays. You had Thursday off and you had school on Saturdays, which, thank God, they've abandoned since then. But other than that, I had no romantic notions. The college and theology seminary at Mundelein, I think I perhaps had romantic notions about what a serious place it was. I mean, I thought it would be a place where we would seriously address the problems of philosophy and theology and the problems of spirituality and prayer, and that we'd be in training to be zealous priests. In fact, the education was fourth rate. We didn't seriously address anything. And we were taught the most important virtue. In fact, the only virtue was obedience. A good priest is one who does what he's told. And I went along, as did my classmates, but I think we didn't buy that seminary at all.
You compare in your book the obedience training to behavior modification. What were some of the techniques that were used to teach obedience to the young men in the seminary?
Well, a totally routinized life where you were governed from morning to night by bells. You were never given enough time in your room. An hour and a half was the most you had in the way of a study period, so you really couldn't get too deeply involved in books. But you weren't given enough time out of your room to do anything but maybe play a brief game of basketball or softball. Everything you did, from the 5:25 bell in the morning to the 9:45 bell at night, was minutely regulated, supervised, controlled. It was to use the sociologist Herbert Gans, God be good to him to use this phrase, it was a total institution from beginning to end. And it was designed to produce externally acceptable behavior. If you went along with the rules, if you weren't caught doing anything wrong, if you adjusted to the routine of daily life, then you were fit for ordination. It was thought that such training would prepare us to be associate pastors, assistant pastors, as we would have said that day, in those days, in the archdiocese. And it might have worked if it hadn't been for the Vatican Council and the changes in the church. It might have been the life in which we, it might have been that a life shaped by the behavior modification techniques of the seminary would have sustained us in the priesthood. As it was, maybe 20% of those who went through the behavior mod seminary just could not adjust for one way or another to the open pluralistic church that began at the end of the Vatican Council. And so they left the priesthood.
When did the Vatican Council come in terms of your training and
well, I was ordained in 1954. The council, I think, was convened in 1961. So I'd been a priest for 6 or 7 years. Matter of fact, I had just started the graduate school at the University of Chicago. I was very fortunate because, you see, before the council, we priests didn't have to make too many decisions. Having decided to be a priest, if you did what your pastor told, or if you were a pastor, you did what the bishop told and followed the routine practices of pastors around the city, you could go on automatic pilot, so to speak. With the Vatican Council, you were on your own. You had to make all kinds of decisions you thought you would never have faced before. By going to the University of Chicago in 1960, at the time Pope John was in the Vatican and John Kennedy was running for president, I found myself pushed out into the outside world. I won't say the real world. I don't know if the university was any more real than the suburban parish I was in. But it was a different world where I wasn't accorded respect just because I was a priest and where there were no paradigms. There were no models for me to imitate. And I found I enjoyed it enormously.
My guest is Andrew Greeley, who's just written an autobiography. It's titled Confessions of a Parish Priest. Let's get back to the seminary for a minute. When you were being trained in obedience and being obedient to the bells that would ring all the time that would tell you when to do what, did you feel like you were obeying the commands of God or of bureaucracy?
Well, a little bit of both. The bureaucracy claimed to speak for God. And while I didn't accept that interpretation totally, it did seem to me it was true to this extent that if I wanted to get through the seminary and be ordained and be a priest, which is what I wanted to do, then I had to go along. So I went along.
It can be like a discipline, can it, to just like give yourself over to another structure?
Sure.
Did it have that effect on you?
It was a monastic life, except we weren't being trained for monastic work. We were trained to be priests for the emergent upper middle class Catholicism. And so there was no link between what I encountered the first day in Christ the King Parish in July of 1954. There was no link between that and anything that happened to the seminary. I was dumped out totally unprepared.
It also seems that a lot of the theological learning that you did was by rote with, I think, true or false quizzes on it, memorization, instead of really penetrating.
Not only memorization, but memorization in Latin. And it could have been Greek, I suppose it could have been worse. On the other hand, it was also true that there was time to study and to read. I could deal with the memorizing maybe with a quarter of my study time. So I began, in about 1950, to read the great French Catholic theologians of that era, Teilhard de Chardin, Henri de Lubac, Jean Dernier Loup. And these were the men that shaped the Vatican Council. So even at ordination in 54, I had in my head the ideas which would begin to flourish in the early 60s. So I was, in this respect, too, I was much luckier than many of my contemporaries.
As celibates, you were warned to protect yourselves from women. You were warned against the ballet. What were the harms of the ballet?
Well, that is, I think, the typical incident of the seminary. It was in the winter of 1950, and we were preparing to go home for the winter vacation in January. We had to stay out there for Christmas, but we're going home in January. Bitter cold winter evening, the ancient Jesuit spiritual director came in and warned us to avoid the ballet while we were home on vacation. Well, you know, we didn't know what he was talking about. Finally, it dawned on me, and I wrote in a piece of paper and gave it to the fellow next to me, ballet. We had had the film a few weeks before called The Red Danube, based on Bruce Marshall's novel Vespers for Vienna, in which a very young Janet Leigh played a ballerina and cavorted around for a part of the film in what might have been considered in those days a relatively skimpy ballerina costume. And apparently this poor old man was afraid that, you know, these are Irish and German and Italian and Polish kids in 1950, most of whose parents hadn't gone to college. We were going to go home on the vacation and rush off to the ballets so we could ogle bodies like Janet Leigh's. And of course, you know, most of us couldn't have committed a ballet if we wanted to. We wouldn't know where to go to see it. It was funny, but it was also sort of tragic, because the idea was that the beautiful human body, the beautiful body of a woman, was somehow evil, and that it was not made to be enjoyed. Of course it's been made to enjoy. You respect the person, but you don't flee from it as though it's the work of the devil. And again, in 4 years, we were going to be out working in a world which was marginally more woman than men, and some of whom might even be attractive. So it was craziness. It was just craziness. And we knew it.
What were some of the other ways that you were warned against women and told about the dangers of female sexuality?
Well, we were warned that when we were home on vacation to avoid the women that we'd gone to grammar school with, because they were now at a marriage age and they would be looking for husbands, and it was really an accomplishment for a woman to win someone away from the seminary. So if we saw them in back of church after Mass, we were told to avoid them. I looked. There were none of my women classmates there, so I didn't have anybody to avoid.
What effect do you think it had on the men in the seminary to have this training about the negativity of women, like when they entered the world and when they had a parish? And as you pointed out, there were women in it.
All over the place, yes.
Do you think that it was like negative reinforcement about women?
Well, it was certainly negative reinforcement. And worse, it was keeping us in a state of immaturity. We were not developing mature, self-focusing, self-energizing patterns to deal with anybody, men or women, but especially with women. So, you know, we were dumped on the world in 1954 with the interaction skills, the relational skills of late teenagers. And we had to grow up in an awful hurry. Some of us did, some of us didn't.
Just at a time in a man's age when he's thinking about dating and shortly marrying and starting to really get very involved in his own sexuality, you, as someone who was preparing to be a priest, was learning about celibacy. Were you given any counseling on how to control the sexually awakened feelings that any man of that age would experience?
Not really. It was mostly behavior mod again. Repression, repression, repression. Don't get involved with women. Avoid them. Don't become friendly with them. They're dangerous. They're a threat to your vocation. This wasn't at our seminary, another seminary. The rector told the students, remember that every woman is a womb waiting to be fecundated, which I say certainly offensive. I think it would have been offensive even in those days to many of us. Now, I should hasten to add, before people tune the radio off, that the seminaries aren't that way anymore. They're much, much different and improved. I'm not sure whether they're exactly what I'd like a seminary to be, because I don't think they're even now places of intellectual preparation. But they're certainly not as bad as the behavior mod seminary of the middle 50s.
Is there anyone that you can talk to when you're coping with celibacy? I mean, can you talk to priests about it? Can you talk to other people in the seminary about it?
Well, in those days, no. I mean, if you were attracted to a young woman or even in love with her, and you told anyone this, you might be on the train back to Chicago by before sunset. So you kept your feelings to yourself. Maybe you could talk to some of your friends, but it wasn't always clear that you could trust them either. Again, that's changed. It is assumed now in the seminaries that young men who are going to be priests have had some kind of normal friendships with young women in the course of their maturation.
Would you feel guilty for just thinking certain thoughts?
Well, you were supposed to. I remember one of the deans of discipline, I suppose we should call them, deans of men, saying that after a while you start imagining you hear the click of heels on the sidewalk. He was joking. But he was right. I mean, it was that strange a place that you can see women from one end of the year to the other. And at that age in life, you would start imagining heels on the sidewalk. Now, if we were going to be monks, as I said before, who were going to spend all our lives in a monastic situation, that would be one thing. And even then, I'm not sure that'd be altogether healthy. But certainly not for the future parish priests.
What are your opinions now on celibacy for priests? Do you think that priests should have a celibate life?
Yeah, I'm asked, would you do it again? And that's a very tricky question. Given what I know now, yes. But at that age in life, if it was a pure free choice, I'm not so sure whether I would have chosen it then. I don't know. But I'm personally committed to celibacy. I think it's a powerful witness in the church, not because marriage is wrong, not because women are wrong, but because it represents a special sort of dedication and a special kind of freedom. My solution to the problem of priests, well, first of all, I think we ought to ordain women. I have no problem with that at all. But I also think we should realistically realize that with the increased life expectancy, we perhaps can't ask people to be priests all their lives, at least to be active priests. So I've advocated something like a priest corps, comparable with the Peace Corps. Come and be a priest for 5 or 10 years, renewable. And if you've given us a certain segment of your life, and then you're burned out, you can't stand teenagers anymore, which at 40 is a common enough reaction, and you want to do something else, you want to start a family, then we thank you and you go forth with dignity and gratitude, still indeed in principle the priest, but now no longer held to priestly worker obligations. I think that would solve our problems overnight. You see, until, well, about 150 years ago in the Western world, and more recently than that in other parts of the world, the typical priest lived to be about 35. Life expectancy wasn't much longer. So to be a priest for all your life was 10 years. Now it's 50 on the average. So I think we have to take into account both the different demands on priests today and the much greater life expectancy and sort of factor that into our calculus when we decide what we want of priests.
My guest is Andrew Greeley. He's written an autobiography. It's titled Confessions of a Parish Priest. The first parish you were assigned to was, I think, suburban Chicago. It was a prosperous, middle-class Irish neighborhood. And I got the impression you were prepared for a more working-class, immigrant neighborhood. Did it change your sense of what your role was supposed to be, knowing that it was a more prosperous, and I think it was like fourth-generation Irish?
Third and fourth-generation college-educated professional. But still very Irish. I would say Christ the King Parish in the Beverly District, the 19th Ward of Chicago, is one of the two or three great formative influences on my life. It was and is a magic neighborhood, and I was just dazzled. It was one of the first, mind you, this is 9 years after the end of the Second World War, it was one of the first college-educated parishes. And it was an active, challenging, fascinating place. It was like nothing for which we'd been prepared. And while I wasn't a sociologist then, I had read enough sociology to know that this is where Catholicism was going, that we were leaving behind the old neighborhoods, the immigrant neighborhoods, and we were going through a major social transformation. And as Everett Hughes, who was a professor at the University of Chicago and later would become one of my mentors there, said, study your parish very carefully, Father Greeley, and take notes on it, because that's the Catholicism of the future. And of course, he was right.
So what did you think were the implications of that?
Well, there were at that stage of the game, we were infested by a bunch of French priest sociologists who came to the United States, were astonished at the high levels of religious practice, and told us all that when the Catholic population became well-educated and acculturated into American life, they would leave the church, that their religiousness was a function of being immigrants. Well, they didn't look very carefully at American life because, of course, religion is part of your social location, your self-definition, as Will Herberg would point out, no matter what social level you're at. So I was fascinated to see where this would be true at Christ the King. And in fact, exactly the opposite was the case. The people became, if anything, more intense Catholics. And that parish stays alive in my stories of St. Praxedes. It's the parish in which many of my characters live.
You were an assistant pastor, and you describe your pastor there as being very jealous and suspicious. What were some of the ways that jealousy and suspicion were expressed?
Well, the poor man, he was not in good health. His hearing was failing. He knew the church was changing, and while in principle he was favor of the changes, they made him nervous. And it was his parish. He'd founded it. Was his people. And he viewed each associate pastor, assistant pastor, I guess we were in those days, as a threat. And so he did his best to keep us away from the people. He wouldn't let us say the last two Masses on Sunday, where most of the people came. He brought in Carmelite monks to say those Masses. He wouldn't let us stand back at church and talk to the people. He pretty much prevented me from relating to any of the adults in the parish. I could go to Christian Family Movement group meetings, but that was about all. I was given the kids, or teenagers were given me. Teach in the grammar school, work with the teenagers, and that was about it. And stay in the rectory and wait for phone calls. As a matter of fact, when I would go out in the afternoons to visit the local hospitals on foot, because he wouldn't let me have a car, he would be very suspicious. Well, now, where were you this afternoon? Well, I went to Little Company Mary Hospital. Well, how do I know that? I said, geez, you could follow me. You know? It was a very, very strange relationship. And I did not confront it with the maturity I should have. I mean, he wasn't behaving very much like an adult, but neither was I. So,
what did you do that was immature?
Well, I let him get away with it. I never challenged this sort of thing.
Well, how would you challenge it? Talk to him, or did you have any
recourse? Yeah, well, see, the few times I did get mad at him and shout at him, he'd back off. And I think it would have been a much better relationship if early on I'd say, hey, you can't do this to us. But you see, we weren't trained in the seminary to do that. Then later on,
you were trained not to do that.
Yeah, later on when he retired, and the young priest that followed us, and he was living there as a retired pastor, said he was a wonderful man, which is the reputation he had when he was a teacher in the seminary. It just happened that I was there at a bad time in his life and in my life.
You gave absolution to people who told you in confession that they were using birth control.
Mm-hmm.
This was not part of what you were supposed to do. How did you decide to do that?
Well, for the first 10 years or so, Terry, people would confess it and say they were going to try not to do it again, and you would give them absolution. That was routine practice. It was a real bind for us, and I feel awfully sorry for some of the people that I could have been more helpful to and wasn't. Because on the one hand, we knew how important sex was in their marriage for healing and renewing. On the other hand, we had these rules that we really thought were unchangeable, and they thought were unchangeable. And so looking back on it, there was something of a charade about it. What happened in the middle 60s with the Vatican Council is and Pope Paul VI would not, the bishops of the world wanted to discuss the issue, and if they'd been permitted to discuss it, they would have changed the rule. The Pope wouldn't let them discuss it, but he set up a commission that was supposed to advise him. He was really looking at that point for a way to change. Well, the very act of setting up a commission, you see, suggested that it was changeable. And the lay people took their cues from that, and we did too. I read a book by John Noonan, who is now professor at Cal Berkeley at that time, on the history of the church's attitudes towards contraception. I was astonished to find that at other times in the history of the church, the position was much less insisted on than it was at that time, where all through 19th century France, the Vatican kept telling the French clergy not to trouble the lay people on these matters. The French were controlling their population with coitus interruptus, and then the Vatican was saying, don't trouble them. Don't ask questions about the marriage practices of the laity. And so that made me realize that there was a relativity to the particular position we were taking then. And so in the years, I would say between 1965 and 1970, we had a revolution in the attitudes of the lay people and the lower clergy on birth control.
But by that time, you were already out of the parish.
Well, but I was still doing parish work on weekends. And you know, it was, people would call me, even though I'd been transferred away from Christ the King, people would call me, people I'd taught in grammar school, hung around the high club, and say, well, Father, I'd like to ask you kind of a personal question. And of course, I knew what was coming. And I would say, what do you think in your own conscience? Well, in my own conscience, I don't think, well, follow your conscience, which is, of course, the advice that 9 out of 10 priests in the country were giving in 1970 and are still giving.
Well, did you then ever get chastised by your superiors in the church?
Well, they wouldn't know what was going on in confession, of course. But they wouldn't know what was happening in a particular confessional. The bishops in this country knew then and know now what their priests are doing, and they know there's no way to stop it, and I suspect very large numbers of them wouldn't want to stop it if they could.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Greeley. And he's written an autobiography which is titled Confessions of a Parish Priest. What were some of the ways your life was changed by Vatican II? Were there any principles that you had grown some accustomed to that you felt you didn't want to change, even though Vatican II had changed?
Oh, no,
them?
I wanted to change.
You wanted them changed.
I welcomed enthusiastically all of the changes of the Vatican Council. Some of the things that happened since then I'm less enthusiastic about, because I think that not so much the council itself, but a lot of priests, nuns, lay teachers, since the council have tended to throw out the baby with the bathwater. They have rejected everything in the church from before 1963. For example, on this station, Gregorian chant. Huh? Beautiful, beautiful music. I was listening over the television station I was at earlier in the day. There was some play about nuns, and there were people singing Gregorian chant. Lovely music. We've substituted guitar music for that. Well, I have nothing against guitar music, but I think we should have saved the chant. Or the saints, which are wonderful examples of the stories of God. The Blessed Mother, Mary, the mother of Jesus, is the only female deity in the marketplace, the only mother goddess around. So I think there's a lot in our tradition that we're now going to have to rediscover, which needs perhaps to be rearticulated and be reformulated. But the Mary symbol, for example, which was the dominant symbol in the Western world for 1,500 years, is just too good to dismiss as excess ecumenical baggage. But the changes of the council itself, I welcome them enthusiastically.
Not all the priests did. You write about how some priests were really devastated by this sudden change and ended up leaving the clergy.
Well, I think it's a little more complicated than that. There were people that were probably in sympathy with the changes, but who had been prepared to deal with a rigid church. And when the church stopped being rigid, they either couldn't cope or they now saw freedom to get out of a priesthood in which they weren't happy. I think most men that left the priesthood and leave it because they're just not happy as priests. If celibacy is possible and even not a terribly difficult thing, if you're happy in the work, if you're not happy, well, then it becomes impossible.
How did you explain the changes to people in your parish? And what were the most difficult ones to explain?
You know, it wasn't hard. I mean, they liked the Mass in English. They liked the altar turning around facing the people. They didn't mind eating meat on Friday. That didn't bother them. They certainly welcomed the de facto change that happened in birth control. I mean, the Vatican didn't change, but the clergy did. They liked the fact that those APA, dirty APA Protestants suddenly became separated brothers and sisters. I mean, ecumenism was most welcome. So it wasn't hard. I remember the first time that I even talked to a Lutheran minister. I mean, we never even talked to the non-Catholic clergy. A couple kids in my parish had to do term papers for their high school class on Lutherans. Well, they came to me and I said, you know, why don't you go talk to Pastor so-and-so? Well, gee, I don't know. I'll call him. So I called him, and I said, Pastor, ecumenism is here. Some of my kids want to come over and get. Oh, he said, fine. And then the next week, there were some of his kids at my place looking for help with their term papers. So thus did ecumenism come to the parish. No, it wasn't. Most people, and then later on when we would do serious academic research in the matter, about 75% of American Catholics, 75-80%, accepted the changes enthusiastically. Even, you know, you get to people over 60, well, all right, it goes from 75 to 65%. But the changes were welcome.
You started going to graduate school, and you got, I think, your doctorate. in sociology, and you started eventually doing a lot of church-related sociological research. Why did you want to go to graduate school?
Well, I had become more and more interested in this question, the social change going on in American Catholicism. And when that change was converging with the changes that were happening because of the council, it was clear that we were in a major transitional crisis, and I wanted to be equipped to understand it better and to make a contribution out of that understanding to what I thought might be a smoother change. I also was convinced, because of the priests that had influence in my thinking at that time, that if you're going to do something, you should do it well, that we ought to be professionals, not amateurs. We ought to be really good at what we're doing. And I felt you couldn't be really good at sociology so long as you were an amateur sitting in a rectory and writing out your opinions. So I wanted to go to graduate school to master the craft of social research.
When did you get out of school?
I went to the University of Chicago in 1960, and I got my degree in 1962, my doctorate.
Not too long after that, you were basically relieved of your duties at the parish and were told to work full-time as a researcher and writer. Did you welcome that reassignment?
Well, if they had left me at Christ the King, I would still be doing both. You see, by 1964, I was a full-time staff member at the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago and a full-time parish priest. And it was rough. But I loved it, you see. I loved both worlds, and I would never have willingly given up either. But then I was transferred from Christ the King to a parish near the university, and it was supposed to make my life easier. In fact, it made it more difficult because the pastor at this new parish really didn't want someone around who was not completely under his control. So in 1965, I said to Cardinal Meyer, who had sent me to graduate school, I can't do both, you know, one or the other. And at that time, he released me from parish work. But you know, while I welcomed the chance to devote myself more to scholarship and writing, I always missed Christ the King. I still miss it. It's in my bloodstream. And I like to do weekend parish work, which I do in Arizona and Tucson, where I teach at the University of Arizona in the second semester.
In some of the studies that you've done, you've been the bearer of bad news.
Oh, boy, yes.
Does the church ever want to kill the messenger, so to speak?
Oh, I think so. But they find that I'm a moving target, and they can't nail me quite as easily as they might. The good news, of course, is that we have survived this last 30 years of transition with remarkably few losses. I mean, the defection rate from those who were born Catholic, I think, was something like 12 or 13% back in 1960. It's now 15, 16%. It hasn't changed much. And while church attendance declined sharply in the wake of the birth control encyclical, that decline leveled off in 1975. And some of the projections my colleagues and I have done would indicate that as far down as people in their early 20s now, when they're in their 40s, they'll be as likely to go to church as their parents. So we have survived this incredible period of tumult and trouble and turbulence relatively well. In fact, I think there's very little that the Vatican or the national hierarchy of the cardinals or weak poor priests can do to drive the laity out of the church. They've opted to stay in on their own terms, indeed, but they've opted to stay in. So that's the good news. The bad news is that they're staying in on their own terms, and their own terms is that they decide what it takes to be Catholic. Now, people come along and say they can't do that. Well, maybe they can't, but they do. And one of the things is that they just simply now reject in overwhelming numbers. They reject the church's sexual teachings.
So the Vatican does not have control over individual Catholics?
Nope. I think it never had quite as much control as it might have been thought, but certainly it doesn't anymore. In some respects, you know, in other respects, they talk about nuclear weapons, they talk about peace, that's another matter that they have a lot of influence. Talk about sex, the attitude of the typical layperson is just they don't know. They don't know what it's like. And to tell you the truth, that's the attitude of the typical parish priest, who all you have to do is be with lay people, and you realize how unrealistic is the orientation of the Vatican on sexuality. I remember one of my colleagues coming into my office with a document that some minor Roman commission had issued in which they said the married lay people should be warned of the dangers of unbridled sex. And he says, don't the damn fools know that the real problem is there's too much bridled sex, and the only thing that keeps us together through thick and thin are the occasional interludes of unbridled sex, which, of course, is perfectly true. I mean, it's obvious enough to everyone, except the people in the Vatican that write documents, and they just don't know.
My guest is Andrew Greeley, and he's written a new autobiography. It's titled Confessions of a Parish Priest. You started writing books, and initially they were nonfiction books, books about sociology mm-hmm. based on the studies you were doing. But then you started writing novels, which I think, at least to lay people, were a lot more, to the church too, I think were a lot more controversial than your nonfiction books, no matter what your findings were in nonfiction. And this was partially because you had introduced the subject of sex to your fiction. Did you need anybody's permission to either write or have published your novels?
No, Cardinal Stritch gave me permission to write back in the late 1950s, and it's never been revoked. But I don't think that would be taken seriously anymore. I mean, the church no longer tries to prevent people from writing, and it realizes that to write, to express yourself, is a basic human freedom, and it can be neither taken or given away. If I was writing on theological issues, or if I was doing catechisms, then I would need approval of the works. But there's no rules that say a priest can't write novels. So I have never asked permission for it.
Did anyone have to read it before publication?
No. But I mean, out of prudence properly understood, I had lots of people read the books before publication, but no bishop. And not for permission, just for suggestions and recommendations.
I believe in a couple of your novels that priests who have taken vows of celibacy actually have sexual encounters and then have to figure out what to do.
And some priests don't, too. I think a lot of the presumed scandal over this is hypocrisy. We live in an era when 20% of the men that are ordained priests have left to get married, and many of them, have had love affairs with people before they leave. It's well known. I mean, the fact that I write books about it, it doesn't shock anybody to know these things happen because they've happened in their parishes. So I think a lot of the shock was kind of a pharisaical scandal, and it happened among some book reviewers and some feature writers and some clergy. The research I've done on my readers indicate that just is not true of the ordinary readers of the books. They're not shocked at all.
Are you not supposed to be imagining sex as a celibate? Do you know what I'm saying? Because, like, to write about it, you have to be thinking about it.
Yeah,
and you have to imagine it. And I wonder if that's considered acceptable.
People used to confess in confession in the old days. They don't anymore. Well, I had dirty thoughts, but I didn't take pleasure in them, which always made me wonder, well, then why have them, you see? I mean, you know, we are equipped with hormones and fantasies precisely because that's part of being human. And and to say that we don't imagine such things is to deny us basic humanity. There's only two reasons that I can think of why a priest shouldn't have erotic dimensions in his writing. One is that sex is dirty or evil. And the other is that priests aren't members of the human race. And both of those positions are heresies.
So, but you think priests shouldn't have sex, but it's okay to think about it, and you'd make that distinction, which...
Well, I mean, if you've taken a vow of celibacy, of course, you try to keep the vow. But that vow doesn't mean that your imagination stops working. Now, if you do nothing but fantasize, I mean, if fantasy becomes the goal of your life, well, then obviously that's a form of emotional disorder. But if you, when passing an attractive woman, are not aware of her possibilities as a bed partner, then you need a medical examination. I mean, now also you've probably got to think of her as a person and all kinds of other things, and you restrain whatever impulses you have, not only with the notion that's not an option for you, but also that she has to be treated, even your imagination, as more than a sex object.
It's my understanding that you've never been formally rebuked or punished by the church for any of your views or any of, you know, for the novels you've written or for any of the disagreements you've had in the church. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
Are you surprised that you've been able to be as outspoken as you are, write the novels that you have, and not be rebuked?
Well, first of all, they don't pay my salary. So they can't fire me from any position. They can't say you are no longer fit to be a professor at a Catholic university because I'm not. Secondly, my disagreements are not doctrinal. I mean, I criticize incompetence. For example, I was very critical of the late Cardinal Cody because he was closing down the inner-city Catholic schools, the black and Hispanic schools in the inner city, which I thought was a terrible thing, but that's not a matter of doctrine. And the themes of my novels are solidly Orthodox Catholic themes. Human love is a metaphor for divine love. I mean, that runs all through the tradition. It goes back to St. Paul and into the Jewish scriptures. So nobody can fault that. All they can say is that the novels are inappropriate for a priest. Well, what's appropriate? Who decides what's appropriate? My own cardinal told me the summer before last that he didn't want me doing parish work in Chicago as long as I wrote novels of the sort I wrote. And so I quoted the correspondence, I quoted the research I'd done, I cited some of the serious scholarly books that are being written about my fiction. And he says, oh no, he says, that's not my problem. My problem is not the people who read your books and may benefit from them or are not shocked by them. He said, my problem is the people who don't read them but are shocked that you wrote them. My problem is the image that people have of the books. Well, that, of course, is an impossible situation for a writer to be in. You've got to write in such a way as not to offend the people that don't read your books. And I said to him, I said, Joe, I'm going to be a priest and a writer as long as God gives me life. And he laughed. He said, I know that. So he didn't. There were never any orders. He would prefer I stop writing them, but he knows I'm not going to.
Would it be hard for you to work at a parish because of your outspokenness?
Well, I don't know. I think it would work both ways. There would be people that wouldn't like it, but then there would be people that would be enthused. The parishes I work in Tucson, the positive response is overwhelming.
I'm thinking about the church, though. I'm not talking about the people in the parish, but rather the church hierarchy.
I think the Archbishop of Chicago presently would be very embarrassed to have me doing parish work in his diocese, but the Bishop of Tucson isn't. But then the Bishop of Tucson isn't responsible for me, and Cardinal Bernardine is responsible for me. So he told a reporter once that he had three great national problems: abortion, in which he wasn't thought to be vigorous enough; nuclear disarmament, in which he was thought to be too vigorous; and Andrew Greeley. And as I say in the book, I have God. God speaks periodically in Confessions of a Parish Priest, and she speaks as a God, our mother. She speaks as an Irish mother. And she says, ah, sure, boy, you ought not to be that kind of a problem to himself. You're not that important.
I'm going to ask you a question I know you've been asked a million times, which is, if you were asked by the Archbishop to stop writing novels, would you stop? What would you
do?
Well,
he asked me. He didn't tell me. And it is, I don't think in Joseph Louis Bernardine's character to give an order like that. If he did, I'd say, go away, Joe. I'm going to keep writing. It's not in your power to permit me to write, and it's not in your power to take it away.
You've written that Rome has turned the system over to lunatics, meaning what?
Well, I had in mind, in particular, I think in that passage, the kinds of men who were made bishops of the major dioceses after the Vatican Council. Here we had this tremendously painful and turbulent transition going on, and the men that were put in positions of power just, and Cardinal Cody in Chicago being the classic example of it, just were not in touch with the people and had no idea how to respond to what was happening.
If you have certain disagreements, which you do, with the church hierarchy and the church structure, not with the theology, but mm-hmm. with the men who actually run the church, how have you been able to stay? I mean, why have you stayed? Some people stay and some people leave.
I like being a priest. I like the Catholic heritage and community. And I've been around enough in other parts of the world, the university, the book publishing world, the journalism world, to know that practically no human organization is run well. Murphy's Law is by no means limited to the church, nor Sturgeon's Law, which says in any given situation 90% of the people foul up. I mean, we're not necessarily the worst of the human corporate structures. Probably because we're so efficient, so inefficient, we give the grassroots units more power by default, and hence are more effective. One of the iron rules, I think, of human organizations is the more power you have out at the grassroots, the stronger the organization is. So precisely because the Catholic Church isn't good at span of control, the typical parish priest has lots of freedom and hence is better able to deal with the problems than he would if the Pope controlled what you preached on Sunday.
Have you said anything publicly about the dismissal of theologian Reverend Charles Curran for contradicting the current church teaching on
but he lost his mandate as a Catholic theologian. Yeah, he wasn't thrown out of the priesthood or anything of the sort. Well, I think it with victories like that, Rome doesn't need many defeats. I mean, they Charles Curran is a competent theologian, reasonably well known to priests, but by no means to all priests, and respected in the theological field. Now they've made him a folk hero to American Catholics. The approach is that the Catholic laity are confused. And if we get rid of the men that are causing the confusion and lay down traditional Catholic doctrine in catechisms, Cardinal Law and Cardinal Kroll here are very much into catechisms, getting it out clear and straight, then the lay people who are basically honest and loyal but a little confused will straighten out and they'll stop practicing birth control. Now, that's silly. Anybody that's been in a parish or anybody that's looked at survey data knows that's silly. I mean, the Catholic married couples are practicing birth control not because of Charles Curran, but because they know that they have to keep their marriages together. So the Vatican, which wants to recapture its influence, thinks it will do so by getting rid of the Charles Currans of the world. In fact, it just loses more of its credibility because the lay people get angry when they see authoritarian and what they take to be unjust measures. And so they rally to Curran support. The resort community in Michigan that I go to in the summertime, it's mostly Irish and Catholic, tend to be politically conservative, but they're all on Curran's side. Because they don't like authoritarian government. They don't like arbitrary decisions. So it's bizarre because even by their own goals, the Vatican is being counterproductive now.
You've been a priest for close to 30 years?
32.
32 years. Yeah. And the church has changed a good deal during that time. You know, American views have changed a good deal during that time. Does it mean something different to be a priest now when people see you walking down the street in your collar, for instance, people who don't recognize you as Andrew Greeley, famous writer and columnist, but people who don't recognize you as Andrew Greeley but recognize that you are a priest, are they apt to have a different immediate reaction to you than they did 30 years ago?
I don't really think so. If anything, Terry, priests are more important now than they were then. They may not realize their own importance. Priest morale is a disaster. I mean, we really have a terrible miasma of confusion and uncertainty and self-disrespect in the priesthood. But to the lay people, they're more important than ever. And for the same reasons, what do you need priests for? Because they're people that speak about the meaning of life and death. And that's as important now as it ever was.
I want to thank you very much for talking
with us.
Nice
to be here, as always, Terry.